Welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and Real Talk is the show I like to say is about anything that piques my curiosity and yours, dear listener. Please send your questions, comments, inquiries to realtalk@voiceofvashon.org. If you have a question, I will do my best to find an expert who can answer it. Or if you have a curiosity about a particular subject, I find myself today curious about World War II from a wholly different perspective. I am pleased to have here in the studio with me Mark Hungerford, author of The Quiet Bower. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Mark, what does The Quiet Bower mean?
That's an interesting question I get asked a lot. The Quiet Bower is a reference to a line in a John Keats poem called The Endymion, which many people know the first couple lines of, a thing of beauty is a joy forever, and so
yes.
on. And my main character in the book, who is a fictionalized representation of my dad, is convalescing in the hospital when he first hears about the, first hears this play and these lines from the play. And he's been in a car accident and is trying to recover from that and realizing that his dreams of being an Air Corps pilot is on the brink of ending because of this accident. And so he's having to really pause and consider what's ahead for himself. And throughout the book, through a number of different events, he ends up at the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal. And it's a very different way of serving the country than he thought he would. And he realizes that only by being in this sort of quiet bower state of reflection and insight does he really get to understand what it means and the value of what he was doing and the value of the War Crimes Tribunal.
Is it kind of the idea of trusting your life or accepting where your life takes you and what this young man learns from that?
It is, and it's definitely a coming-of-age sort of story. So this fellow is quite young when he has the accident. He's still in high school. So his, you know, adult sort of retrospect and insight is not very developed yet. But he's a sensible and intelligent person, and by the time he ends up at Nuremberg as a sergeant in the Air Corps, then he has learned a lot and come to understand that things may not turn out quite like you planned, but there's plenty to learn along the way if you have your eyes open to it.
And you mentioned off mic that you modeled this character after your own father, who had this experience?
Yes, this is the book is a novel, and I fictionalized it, and it's very closely follows my dad's story. I did a great deal of research to write it. My dad was alive at the time and was very free with telling the stories. He had a lot of artifacts, photographs, and so forth that he brought back from the war. And then I did traveling in the United States and Germany to do research for it. And it follows very, very closely what happened. And I was particularly interested in details and period details about movies and life in the military and the music and what was going on in Germany at the time and so forth. Of course, the conversations weren't recorded and I had to make that up, but that's really, I tried to make sure that everything fit and was very accurate in the telling so that the story had authenticity to it that, you know, supported the thesis of the whole thing.
And I'm hearing you talk like a novelist, like an experienced writer, and realizing at the same time, this is your first book.
Yeah, that's right. I had always wanted to do some serious writing and had done a little writing for newspapers and so forth very informally. And then I thought I did want to write a book, and I just had to ask myself what would be something that would carry me through and that would all the work that I knew would be ahead. And since I always had an interest in this time period and my dad's stories, I thought that this would do it, and it definitely did. And the more I learned about what happened to my dad and the importance of the War Crimes Tribunal, the more I realized I had a very good mission to try to fulfill like that.
What did you do to find your writing voice?
Well, that's interesting. A couple of writers have been very influential for me. One, and always had been since I was maybe middle school, would be Ernest Hemingway, and also F. Scott Fitzgerald. I've worked with several editors on the book and had lots of good input. The voice came to me very naturally. The book's written as first person present tense, which is actually difficult to do, but I tried to get away from that to give myself a break a little bit, but I just kept coming right back to it, and it just, the way it flowed out.
So it's written from the perspective of Walt,
Walt telling the story as though it were happening real time.
World War II is a topic that has been covered and covered and covered.
Yes.
What's different about this book? What more is there to say?
Well, I think Walt's perspective as an intelligent young man proceeding through the military with this idea of being a glorious pilot is not unique, but the fact that he did not get to pursue his dream the way he wanted to and ended up at the trials. And then at the trials, he was a radio operator on the plane for Francis Biddle, who was the American judge. So my dad got to go to the trials, participate from the sidelines, as it were, and have this unique perspective of a fellow that's like 20 years old and seeing this sort of from the distance, and also at the same time living, you know, among the German civilian population and then his own, you know, friends in the military. So I think his sort of intelligent and retrospective and thoughtful view of what was going on around him and being able to share that articulately with the reader is what's different and rewarding about the book.
Yeah, not every young man in that situation is going to come away with wisdom.
Yeah.
So this is a fairly unique character. And I'm wondering if the American culture at the time lent itself more to encouraging young men toward analytical or academic thinking or educational curiosity, if you will.
Yeah, it possibly. I think my dad went to a public school in Flint, Michigan, and the first third of the book takes place in Flint, Michigan, at the early years of the war. So he was pretty well educated. It was a large school, with Latin and Greek programs and all sorts of things.
Yeah,
I learned about all
anymore.
Of this stuff. So I think he had, and of course I knew him personally, and he was an intelligent person and very conscientious and thoughtful, and was able to express himself that way. So yeah, he could, he was a good voice for what was going on. I think maybe other people might have been feeling what he felt, but the Walt of the story, it brings this out and explains it to the reader of what's going on and his own. And he's very honest about being confused and feeling one way at one point and feeling another way at another point, and just letting you into his mind is what you're doing. One of my editors suggested that the book was a series of meditations. And at first I kind of balked at that, and then I realized that he was right. And I think that is a pretty good description of it.
Yeah, I guess if it's written in first person, it tends to be, it's inside the head of the main character.
And very immediate. So it's just, what do I feel right now? So you have the benefit of some retrospect, but not long range retrospect.
So what is young Walt's takeaway from this experience? What does he tell us about
Well, the main takeaway is the value of international justice, which is the concept of the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal, and then shortly after the Tokyo trials, what the idea was that that individuals who commit crimes against humanity need to be punished, no matter where they what their position in the military or how high up they are in the government or anywhere else. So Walt brings away an understanding and imparts to the reader, I hope, that this is the answer to preventing war, is that you make people accountable, to the ones who wage it or who are aggressors or commit crimes against humanity. So that is the main message of the book.
Do you personally think that punishing war criminals will stop war crimes?
Yeah, I do. I think that directly it will, and also I feel that when a population has some chance at retribution or rehabilitation or any kind of understanding that they've been wronged, that difference between ethnicities does not simmer and erupt later. It's a good way to hold people accountable and then let it go.
If we are holding people accountable for war crimes, can you drill down, perhaps using Walt's experience, as to how that affects the individual who has been damaged by war?
In Walt's own case, well, Walt is surrounded by the German population, and not, there are Germans that have positions within the occupied territory government that's being run by the American military. I think Walt is not connected with any of them personally, but I think he is sympathetic to the idea that innocent civilians are often the ones who suffer from the actions of their government or policymakers that wage war. I think Walt being sort of the common man, if you will, and just an ordinary soldier, very, very much an ordinary soldier, is able to be sympathetic with the other side a little bit. At the same time, you know, he is definitely not pro-Nazi or anything like that, but he is Nuremberg especially, and Frankfurt, where he was at, was viciously bombed by the Allies, and so the destruction and the annihilation of everything, including the civilian population, has had a big effect on him. So, and he talks about that in the narrative.
We're talking with Mark Hungerford on Real Talk, if you're just joining us. He's the author of a World War II coming-of-age book called The Quiet Bower, based on his dad and his dad's experience as part of the entourage of one of the Nuremberg trials' primary judges. We're here and able to do this thanks in part to programming support from the Vashon Island Chamber of Commerce. The chamber represents over 250 member businesses and organizations on Vashon and supports the community by organizing events such as Halloween, Easter, Christmas, and of course, the Strawberry Festival. Better businesses make a better island. Find an island business at vashonchamber.com. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and Mark Hungerford, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
I'd like for you to read a bit of something that Walt has to say in this book, The Quiet Bower. Walt being a young airman? Is he an airman?
He's a radio operator gunner, his title. Yes, so he's in the Air Corps.
And give us a little background on the excerpt that you're going to read.
I'm going to put this in context a little bit. So Walt and a friend of his named Fergie, who is another radio operator, are stationed in Frankfurt. And this I picked this passage. It talks a little bit about an interaction with the German population. So they've just received instructions from a German woman working at the Red Cross about where they might be able to get a radio that they want to have to listen to in their barracks. Standing at the intersection, the woman had circled on the paper. Fergie and I looked back toward the Red Cross, now long out of view. Eins, zwei, drei, Salgasse, Fergie exclaims in a loud, guttural caricature of German. Knock it off, I tell him, looking around uneasily. It is deathly quiet. As far as you can see in all directions, the streets are still and lifeless, though by now it is midday. Smoke from cooking fires burning in the cellars below rises wistfully among the piles of bricks. Overhead, valiant swaths of pale blue pace the sky. Suddenly, I look up, startled to see a little boy in shorts and overshoes looking down on us from one of the towering piles of rubble. He works the fingers of both hands into V signs and skitters down to the street like a mountain goat, landing amid a tinkling avalanche of red roof tiles. Earlier this morning, when the fog wrapped moodily around our barracks, Fergie and I pocketed our sidearms as though we were resistance agents going on a dangerous mission. Now, as I feel the weight of the loaded .45 in my pocket, I blush at the absurdity of the situation. This 7-year-old, smiling warmly at us with pure trust and friendliness, probably knew 10 times more about violence and death than I ever would. Cowgummy? His eyes are raised in eager hope. I reach into my right-hand pocket and bump into the pistol butt, then try the left-hand one and pull out a 5-cent pack of Wrigley's. Fergie digs the address from his shirt and shows it to the boy, who is already shoving the gum one piece after the other into his mouth. Throwing the empty wrappers into the air with a flourish, he takes my hand and Fergie's, and walking between us, leads us down the block to a doorway that yawns between two piles of rubble. We rap on the door. Shortly, a young man opens it and steps outside. Good morning, he says in English, and we reply politely. He has on a rough-looking knitted sweater and ill-fitting woolen GI pants that ride halfway up his calves. He reeks of body odor and wood smoke and needs a shave. You want to buy something, he asks. Fergie does the talking. We heard from a shopkeeper near the Red Cross that you might have a radio to trade, he tells him, speaking slowly, too loudly. We would like a small radio for our barracks. The man asks us to wait a moment and goes back into the ruin. The little boy stands staring at Fergie and me, inspecting our clothes and boots, squeezing my hand at intervals. Our seller comes back with a radio and a Bakelite case. It has the right plug, one with round prongs that will fit in the socket in the attic of our billets. He holds it out to us. Fergie wiggles the dials and wraps the cord around it. The little boy reaches up, taking it politely from Fergie to inspect. How much? Fergie asks. 2 packs of American cigarettes. Fergie and I each hand him an unopened pack from the inner pocket of our field jacket. He takes them, checking the seals, weighing them in his hands like they were heavy and fragile. How do we know it works? Fergie asks. It works, he says. I have used it myself. With this radio, I can receive London. This is London calling, he says, imitating a stuffy British accent. The little boy looks up, recognizing the familiar phrase, his face open and beaming. The man leans forward. If the police came to your house and found the radio set to London, here, he says, turning the dial to a certain position and letting us see, you could be executed, even if the radio wasn't switched on. He pauses a second as though eager to impress us with the brutality of it, adding in a softer voice while drawing a finger across his Adam's apple, they cut off your head for this. He looks at each of us, measuring our reaction, taking in our clean uniforms and freshly shaven boyish faces. I look back at his own face hollowed with hunger, his eyes red and raw from the smoke and dirt wedged in his pores like black freckles, and think of our neighbors in Flint, who complained ceaselessly that they couldn't get nylons or all the gasoline they wanted, or that their wages were frozen. You want anything else, he asks. Fergie raises his eyebrows. War souvenirs? Guns? We didn't bring anything else to trade, Fergie tells him. He glances at me, probably wondering why I don't speak. You can come back then, with more cigarettes. He holds them up like trophies, smiling with mossy teeth. He looks down at the little boy. Klaus, gib den Soldaten bitte das Radio. The boy hands it to Fergie. Fergie holds out his hands to shake. Man looks a little astonished, but pumps it formally up and down. He doesn't turn to me at all. I realize he doesn't take it for granted I would want to touch him. It gives me a weird feeling to have that kind of power over someone, to be a conqueror. I don't like it. The little boy follows us down to the center of the deserted street and to the corner through the canyons of debris. Asking once more for gum, he flips up the cover of the outside pocket of my field jacket, moving to push his hand inside where the .45 lies butt facing up and banging heavily against my hip. I grab his little hand before it gets in there, squeezing it hard. "Nine," I tell him, suddenly wanting to get away. "No more gum." "Okay," he says, looking a little hurt that I had treated him roughly. I rub his shoulder and suddenly stoop to hug him. Then Fergie and I walk away. When I look back, the boy smiles cheerfully, holding up the V sign with his left hand. Fergie and I shoot back the salute. "V for victim," Fergie says. He looks down at the radio dial. "You really think they'd cut off their heads for listening to a foreign broadcast?" As we continue toward the Red Cross, I think about the army newsreels we've seen and the latest stories about the concentration and death camps. "Sure they would," I answer.
Wow. That's an interchange that says so many things about war, about the innocence of young, privileged, if you will, soldiers, and the maturity or the damage of a child in war, and how those two roles went back and forth, maturity versus innocence, and the sense of a young man calling himself a conqueror. It's heartbreaking.
It's an interesting story also because I actually have a real picture of this boy that my dad took.
Yeah.
So there's a face that goes with it.
So your description was well informed from the photograph.
Yeah, I like to think so anyway.
Yeah. We're talking with Mark Hungerford, author of The Quiet Bower, an unusual perspective on World War II, a coming-of-age story about this young soldier, or airman, Walt. And I was going to ask you about the character arc for this young man. You take him from high school when he's dreaming about being an airman and all the glory that a young man sees in that, through basic training, I guess. And then does he actually see action, or does the war end before he gets...
Yeah, the war ends before he actually goes into any kind of combat.
So he only sees the aftermath.
That's right.
War.
He arrives, he ends up being assigned to the military police, and they ship him to Frankfurt. And then through that, even though he's a airman, it's sort of hard to, the military had many more people in it than they needed when the war ended.
Oh.
So they were trying to decide, you know, what was the best way to make use of people until their term, if you will, ran out. So my dad got sent to be part of the occupational army in Germany and then arrived in the winter after the truce was signed with Germany.
Ah, so let's go to now the idea that, Walt wound up being a chauffeur for
Not exactly.
Judge
Biddle. So is an important person at the trial. There were four judges, an American, French, Russian, and English judge. And Biddle had at his disposal a C-47, which many people would maybe know as a DC-3. It's an early passenger aircraft, fairly large airplane was important enough because of what they were doing. They had a full complement of crew, which included a navigator and a dedicated radio operator. So my dad was a radio operator for Francis Biddle's flying limousine. And they shuttled dignitaries, a lot of films, evidence for the trial back and forth across Europe. So kind of fun for my dad because they were always supposed to be ready to go and spit polished, and they would get instructions to take a film from maybe Nuremberg to Rome or to Prague or some other place like this. So
he was kind of a fly on the wall for these conversations that I imagine went on in the airplane.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Fast forward with us, will you, now to the status of the International War Crimes Court.
Yeah, so the The Nuremberg trials and the Tokyo trials were specifically focused and had jurisdiction over things that happened in World War II. Nothing much like that happened in the world community until the 90s, and there were trials established to prosecute people involved for war crimes in the former Republic of Yugoslavia and also Rwanda. So there were specific trials set up for that. And then you come a little forward, farther forward again to about 2002 or so, when the International Criminal Court was established as a permanent court with no limited jurisdiction as far as timeline goes. And they are in session at The Hague in the Netherlands and prosecuting at this time primarily the cases are have to do with situations in Africa, but they have things going on across four continents, including Iraq and Afghanistan.
Are you aware of cases that are currently before that court? Can you give us a little idea of what they might be?
I'm not super well versed on that. People that are have a strong interest in it, I would send them to the internet, and the International Criminal Court has their own YouTube channel where you can watch proceedings
really?
Against real time, unless they're in closed session. I did a little research just this morning to see what the very latest was, and most of them have to do with atrocities committed in Africa. And conflicts and situations in Africa.
How is the United States involved with the International Criminal Court?
Well, originally, the United States was strongly in support of the court when it was the Rome Statute came out. The Bush administration was not interested in participating and actually was fairly hostile towards the work of the court. Since then, the United States has sort of softened their stand about the court and have been more contributing to the proceedings and offering expert advice and other things. But they're not an active, they're not what's called a state's party in the court at this time.
Oh, that's interesting. That's very interesting.
It's too
bad,
but yeah. It's how it is.
We only have a few minutes left, but would you have an interest in making any sort of intuitive prediction about where the International Criminal Court might be going next?
Well, they're actually very, very strong. They've built a new facility. There's more states parties signing on all the time. They're getting better and better at what they do. Part of their challenge is that there can be thousands of victims to a crime, and so to amass all the evidence is a very challenging thing. Also, since not all countries are on board with the work of the court, it can be hard to extradite people. They're doing the best they can, and they're doing a wonderful job. But I would say people should check out their work. They have an excellent website and many different tutorials and things you can read about it. Human Rights Watch is a strong supporter of the ICC.
So if we Googled ICC and or Human Rights Watch, we could find out more about the International Criminal Court. Mark Hungerford, author of The Quiet Bower, I want to thank you so much for joining us on Real Talk. Tell us a little bit about how you actually printed this book and why, and where can we get it?
Okay, so the book is created as a replica of an Armed Services Edition publication. Those books were distributed to American military personnel in World War II. It has a very unique look. It's the spine is shorter than the width. It's printed on something that looks like newsprint. Mine is not really newsprint, but the original ones were. The original ones were stapled together, kind of low quality. They wanted to get books into the hands of servicemen for a little bit of a diversion. My book is much better quality and will last a long time. The book was created by a book designer who's got a long-standing connection with Vashon Island. Sandy Nelson did a wonderful job, and her husband, Chris Brown, did the beautiful website. At thequietbower.com, which people can visit and learn more about the book. You can buy the book at Vashon bookshop right here, mm-hmm. Near the studio. Casey down at Bookman West sells the book. You can get it at Finney Books in Seattle. I'm working on getting in the local libraries, and you can also order it through the website, but I would encourage you to support the local businesses if you can.
Mark Hungerford, thank you very much. If you folks would like to immerse yourselves in World War II and in the Nuremberg trials, get this book, The Quiet Power. Thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Real Talk here on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. Stay tuned for what comes up next. You never know what you're going to get on KVSH.